Accession number 30633, Mr. James Farquharson, Reel 8. Now, anything before you leave 10th Light AA, or have we done pretty well everything? You were there until January 42.
Yes, so there came Christmas, of course. There were occasional entertainments in the camp. I remember the famous Irish tenor, Count John McCormack, came and sang to us, The Garden Where the Praties Grow, and things like that, leaning against a piano with a small palm tree behind, introduced rather ineffectually, I think, by the chaplain. It was all rather embarrassing. there were other people as well who came entertain us, who didn't interest me as much, I suppose, and therefore I don't remember at all. And at Christmas, I remember on Christmas Day going with one or two other friends on bicycles, and we were allowed to draw bicycles from a store, I think, and we bicycled to Camberley, and we must have done it more than once. On Christmas Day, we went and had Christmas dinner in the, oh God, I can't remember its name now, but anyhow, the principal hotel in Camberley, which was on the A30 as it went through. And I've seen it hundreds of times in later years, and spent the evening there, bicycled back, I suppose, but on another evening, perhaps it was Boxing Night or something, perhaps at the hotel we got to know some ATS, I suppose they were, who were billeted in the Spanish ambassador's country house at Camberley, which was requisitioned. And they invited us round, I remember, and I had the extraordinary, shocking experience of being served red wine in an enamel mug. Can you imagine? I mean, somehow they didn't go together. It didn't taste like wine out of a mug instead of a glass. And then we bicycled back to the barracks. But for the rest, I can't really remember anything else much.
Was there a passing out parade?
No, not for us. I don't remember.
So where next?
I mean, we were really waiting our turn, waiting to be summoned to Octu, I think. I don't know how soon a place was arranged for us there. I mean, we were allocated again to a certain course serial at Shrivenham.
Now, what was the name of the officer cadet unit, do you know? Did it have a number or a battalion?
It was number something. Could it be number 7? Octu. It was a Royal Artillery, certainly. And it was established in the great barracks, always known in those days as Belisha Barracks, because the then War Minister, Hoare Belisha, in preparation for the war, it's one of the few things that was done, built enormous barrack blocks in various parts of the country, Catterick in Yorkshire, for one, and certainly Shrivenham, two gigantic Georgian-style barrack blocks, again in a sort of, they were H-shaped, I think. One was called Belford and one was called Beauregard. Beauregard was spelt Beauregard.
Which were you in?
I was in Beauregard. I was in Belford.
B-E-L-F-O-R-D.
Which I suppose must have been named after a general or something like that. I mean, there is a place called Belford in Northumberland, but that wouldn't have given its name to a barracks. And these two separate blocks operated completely separately. They were, in fact, two separate octus, virtually. We didn't know anybody, as far as I remember, in Beauregard.
Now, what was the barrack like? They're fairly modern, obviously.
Very modern, very sumptuous. One chiefly remembers long corridors with barrack rooms opening off them. And the corridors were designed specially to be cleaned easily. There were no sharp angles anywhere. The floor went up in a curve to the wall, and corners were rounded as well. And we were responsible for keeping the corridors in good order. I'll tell you how that was done later, perhaps. And
how many to a room? Was it the same, 30 or so, or 20 or so? Or
On the whole, rather less than that, I think. Probably about a dozen, say, six on each side, something. I may be wrong, it's difficult to remember. Much the same idea, beds aligned down with a passageway down the middle and a locker beside each bed. And I don't remember anything about the ways up and down. We were all certainly on the first floor because if there was any panic, we weren't quite ready and there was still rubbish about or something when the inspecting posse were coming around, we would open the window and throw it all out of the window. Go down on the grass below. But then...
Tell us about the cleaning now. You might as well do it now while we're on.
Oh, before I tell you the...
Which, well...
The geography of the thing.
No, tell you put it in the order you want. That's
yes.
Fine.
Well, I think I'll finish the geography. I mean, there were each barrack, Belford and Borgard, were each exactly the same as far as I know. They consisted of these... They were each had two enormous H-shaped blocks, and between them a building which was the chapel, the naffy, and I don't know where we fed now. Perhaps we were fed in our barrack blocks. I think that the building in between was not large enough for that, but that was the sort of social centre for us. And beside Belford, certainly, the whole length on the north side was an enormous parade ground. I mean, I suppose the whole thing was about a quarter of a mile long, and the parade ground would be about that length. And masses went on the parade ground, gun drill, marching drill, all sorts of things. Now to go to the cleaning, if you like, that was done on Friday evening, so the inspection was at midday on Saturday, and from that moment on we were free till Monday. And on Friday evening, what did we do? There were two things to do. You had to get your own kit layout and everything absolutely perfect, but you also had to get the barrack room perfect, and that meant no dust anywhere. And usually, if the senior inspecting officer didn't do it, the junior officer with him ran his finger along the top of your locker, that sort of thing. And as for the floors, we must have been issued with vast amounts of polish, of sloppy polish, which we laid all over the floor. In the barrack room, we must have moved our beds about to do it, I suppose. And in the corridor, we also laid polish all the way along, so that you had to be very careful in walking in the corridor, that you didn't slip up and fall on your back and that sort of thing, which I did once under similar arrangements in my railway office block when I was about 60 years old and was quite badly injured. But all went well in that respect, but we were given bumpers. Polishers were a great heavy rectangular block on a hinged pole, and we all went up and down the corridor bumping away for all we were worth, and we bumped the floor in the barrack room as well. And then over everything before we went to bed we laid newspaper, masses and masses of newspaper, and tiptoed about. We took our boots off before we came in and that sort of thing. And in the morning, I suppose, I don't think we did much before going on parade, but we got back probably some time, perhaps half an hour before the inspection people came. Rather depended, I suppose, on which room you were in and the route that they followed to do the inspections. But you had time then to pick up all the newspaper, to give a final bump to the floor and make sure that there weren't any blemishes anywhere, and then stand by your beds, the voice would say, and in would come the battery sergeant major, was a dear old boy with a Springer Spaniel, which came trotting along beside him. The officer, and I think it was there that we had Major Willett, who was a very dapper, smart regular soldier, wearing riding breeches, no old style service dress, and certainly a junior of some sort with him, a sort of battery subaltern or something like that, a sort of headquarters junior, and they did the inspection. I can't remember them ever finding fault with anything. It was a formality. They went through, and if the junior officer showed dirt on his finger after running it along the top of the thing, I think the major would say, "Little better next week," or something like that, and walked out of the room. And we were free then.
Now let's look at what. So take me through. I don't know how you want to organise it in your mind, but your training at the Octu. You know, I mean, how did they start? What comes to mind is what they were doing.
I suppose first and foremost, always one remembers gun drill, because that's the thing you were doing all the time.
Well, tell me about that. What is that on? Is that on the 48?
On the 40 millimeter Bofors gun, which was a mobile gun. There were a great many of them were never used in the mobile role. They were designed so that they were on wheels, rubber tires, using jacks, I think. I can't remember. You had various tools that you used. You could jack the end of the gun up and take the wheels off. And then there were round pads on screws behind and handles on top, and you did that. And you got the gun on the ground. And then there were spirit levels both ways, and you then had to level the gun very, very accurately. There was a considerable drill to that, orders of one sort and another, and it sometimes took a considerable time. And before you did that, of course, not only did you screw down the things at the end of the gun, but there were side girders, which were hinged and folded back and locked into the side of the central plate, I mean, the body of the gun. And you pulled out a pin and you swung these out. They then clicked into position out at right angles, so looked vertically down. It was a straightforward plus sign. And you then had pads on those as well, and you were screwed down. So the levelling was done in four positions, in fact. And the gun was then ready for action.
Now, what was the actual loading drill?
The loading drill, the detachment, these things changed in the course of my career. But I think to begin with, you had a bombardier or lance sergeant, or even possibly a sergeant who was in charge of the detachment. The detachment consisted of number two and number three. Number two was the layer for line. He sat in a seat on the right-hand side of the gun with handles like that. And number three was the same on the other side, and he was the layer for elevation. I remember the American Army called the layer for line azimuth, as we once got mixed up in some exercise. And I remember a large black sergeant saying, "Is you on azimuth?" We didn't know what on earth that meant at first. Anyhow, those are the two and three, and then number four was the firing number. He stood on a platform on the gun, level with the breech block at the back end of the barrel. The barrel was detachable, of course. We had a spare barrel, and when it got too hot, you took one out and put the other in. And the number four had the cradle. Let me just say the numbers five and six were the ammunition numbers, and they got the ammunition out of boxes. They had clips, rather like a rifle clip, only much larger, and you clicked four shells into that by their bases. You then picked the four of them up. I can't remember what it was called now. Perhaps a clip.
I think
and walked up to the number four, holding them upright. The number four then took the four of them into his hand, swung round, held them nose forward over the top of a slit in the tail end of the gun, on below which was the loading tray, which was a sort of ditch metal. And you then dropped the shells down, and they came, and there was some sort of plunger or something that unlocked them all, so that they went down one on top of the other. Well, first one on the firing tray, and the next three. Perhaps they were unclipped. Yes, they would be in turn as the gun fired. The gun was capable of firing at automatic, you see, and then the number four. Now, what did he do? He had a handle that pulled up and over, and that would have. Oh yes, the loading tray, of course, had a thing at the tail end into which the base of the shell dropped, which held it in position, and which was spring-loaded. And when you fired the gun, that was released, and it shot the shell into the breech, and automatically the breech block swung shut. And then the gun was ready to fire, and there was a firing pedal, and there was a safety lever on the side, and that had three positions. I can't remember what the three were, except one of them was called held, and every time the number four put the safety catch on, he had to shout held, and then everybody knew it was safe. And if anything awful happened, if the gun didn't fire, that the shell got stuck or it was a dud, the number four instantly pushed the lever down and shouted out, "Stoppage held!" That was a memorable cry in drill. And so the number four was the vital firing man, and then when ordered to fire by the sergeant, he would put his foot on the pedal and drop it down. And, oh yes, the two other positions of the lever, one was auto and one was single, of course. And if it was single, he pressed the pedal and one shell fired. If it was auto, all four went off, one after the other. And, in fact, he could go on, if it was quick enough, and the ammunition numbers were pretty decrepit characters usually, would come quick enough bringing up the clips of shells, he could be feeding them in one after the other. And the gun would be almost firing continuously.
Now, what about, did you get the chance to fire it on the ranges or on some ranges? Or did you just do drill?
We did drill, endless drill. And I don't think we ever fired in the main part of the training. Training was from...
Oh, okay, so let's leave the gun there. That's
yes.
A lot of gun drill on the boat.
A lot of gun drill. We had MT training.
Tell me about that.
We were taught to drive. We went out.
Could you already drive?
I could already drive a car, yes. But we went out with the most appalling old thing. Morris, I can't remember what they were called. They were very inefficient. They had extraordinary engines, underpowered engines, made a terrible guttural.
These lorries.
Lorries, yes, guttural noise. They were of the vintage that didn't have a windscreen properly. Well, they had a windscreen, but nothing over the top except a strip of canvas that you sort of clipped on. And Sergeant Kane, I think he was, Bombardier Kane, was a strange man who taught us. And we were taken out, we were loaded up perhaps about, oh, sorry, this. We were then taken out about four to or half dozen of us or something like that in the lorry and taken to a roadside cafe, a sort of hutted cafe, between Bagshot and Camberley. There we encamped ourselves, we settled, and Bombardier Kane took us each in turn and instructed us. So we were there for the half a day, spending 5/6 of the time or something like that, drinking cups of tea and sitting in the thing waiting our turn or waiting after it. And we didn't never had to take any test or anything like that, I think, but we were just given our turn at learning to drive. And so that was one form of training.
What about maintenance and that kind of
thing? Yes, we learnt maintenance, certainly. Things like the Otto cycle. The Otto cycle, which was something devised by a German, as most things to do with cars were. And it consisted of induction, compression, ignition, exhaust. And it was the moves of the piston in the car. You first drew in the fuel, then you squeezed it, and then the sparking plug fired it, that gave the power, and the piston was driven by it, and then up it came next time, by which time a port had opened and the waste gas went out through the exhaust pipe. And where much was made of all that, we had to learn it and repeat it. And all sorts of things. We learned all about carburettors and every feature of
routine maintenance and how to carry it out. And of course, if you're an officer, make other people carry it out.
We didn't. I don't think we. There was no opportunity to do routine maintenance.
So it was just engine theory and learning to drive.
Yes, though somehow we must have learnt a bit about maintenance, but we didn't do it regularly. I think we were taught what routine maintenance should be, because we certainly knew about it when we were commissioned. And what else? Tactics.
Now tell me about tactics. What level of tactical training were you learning and doing? Or was it much like your OTC? Sort of?
It was not much advanced from that, I think. I don't think we ever went out on exercises. Apart from
so what was
NT.
It? This tactical, what were you actually doing? Was it just lessons?
Oh, wait a minute. I'm getting confused. All this MT training with Bombardier Kane, of course, was from Deep Cut.
Right. So that's before the MT.
That was before, yes.
Okay, I made a note. So.
Yes.
So you didn't do MT training at
Octu. We certainly did motorbike. We rode motorbikes because we had a regular round. The camp was on fairly flat ground, and about half a mile away was the scarp of the Berkshire Downs. And I remember we always used to go on our motorbikes and climb steeply up onto a road that ran along the side of the Downs, and about a mile or two, and then equally steeply and with a hairpin bend, we came down and went back to the barracks.
Was this meant to be training, or was this for fun?
Oh, it's not for fun. This was training.
Now, what about tactical training? You would have done, you should have done that, some of that anyway, at Octu. Do you remember it at all? It seems to have blurred away a bit.
Absolutely blurred away. I simply can't remember. But we certainly did something or other. Map reading certainly was very much to the fore.
Anything new, or was it just the same?
Much the same. Things like identifying targets, indicating targets for rifle fire. We did a lot of rifle drill as well, of course, and maintenance of rifles and so on. I don't think we were issued with rifles.
Were you a good shot?
A good shot? No, I was. I wasn't a bad shot. I was average.
What do you think held you back a bit? I mean, average is average, that's all right, but what do you think stopped you from moving on to being better than average? What do you need to be a good shot? Or did you not think about
it? You needed to be extremely strong in order to hold the rifle, and you had to hold your rifle. I mean, it was a top-heavy thing, you see. You were always supporting it with your left hand, and the more you had to shoot, the worse you got. I mean, your aim gradually deteriorated, I think. You began to shake. We also we did pistol shooting, of course, on a pistol range.
Now, what do you remember? Which pistol?
Well, there, the absurd thing was, I think there were always four fives, which are the largest size of revolver, very heavy, and there. Yes, we did assault course.
I'll come back.
A lot of that.
Pistol training.
Yes, and one of the things at the end of the assault course, the last stage, was to go into the pistol range, pick up a 4-5 off a sort of shelf in front, and fire so many rounds, fire a full magazine, I suppose, at a target, which was a human figure, I think, a sort of metal plate against a curved wall. And I remember that, generally speaking, I never hit the figure at all. Those pistols had an incredible kick, and the thing would go up like that when you fired it, and I think it was on its way up by the time the bullet went out. Fortunately, of course, when I was commissioned, I was issued with a 3.8 revolver. Even that was rarely larger than was necessary. You think that the pistols that the German officers were issued with, much lighter weight and equally efficient, Walter and things like and Mauser and so on.
Now, what about this assault course? What do you remember of the
assault course? I remember very well. There were the usual the obstacles that you see in Dad's army and things like that. An enormous wall created from old-fashioned petrol tank cans, which, you know, were not like the jerry can that we copied from the Germans, which was refillable. These were dischargeable, and you just threw them away when you'd taken the petrol out of them. And they used to be filled with earth and then built like bricks into a great wall. And at about 7 or 8 feet high, I think, and you had to get over this wall somehow, and there was no foothold. What you did, this was done in collaboration with somebody else. Somebody cupped his hands. You then put your foot on his hands, and he heaved you up and threw you over. And I was partnered by a chap called Curly Diamond, who was bald-headed, rosy-cheeked, and weighed about 18 stone. And I couldn't get him. I mean, if he stood on my hands, they parted, and he fell through onto the ground. So he never went over the wall at all, and he flipped me over quite easily.
What else was there?
Oh, there were canvas tunnels to go through, as dogs do. You see on dog crufts and things like that. You wriggled your way through, carrying a rifle with you. You swung your way across a stream on a rope, on a running line. And this was quite difficult to do because the stream had a sort of cliff on the far side and a slope down to the water on the near side, so you took a run at it, and you had to swing yourself up enough to land on the cliff and actually get yourself standing on the cliff. Most people, if they got their legs on at all, then went backwards and we all dropped in the water. And I forget other obstacles. There were plenty of things, anyhow, to be done in going round.
Sounds quite tough.
It was very tough.